In therapy and in music, the baseline informs where we go to next. This is the show that examines the present state of music therapy and asks, where to from here? Welcome to Baselines with Joe Thompson. This podcast was made on the lands of the Darug people. Jesse Teach is a PhD candidate in music and health sciences at the University of Toronto. In 2007, she received a Bachelor of Music in Music Education from Berklee College of Music. After graduating magna cum laude, Jesse taught lessons while pursuing a music career, during which she won over a dozen international songwriting awards and recorded several albums, including two in Paris. In 2017, after a decade-long career, she decided to restructure the role that music played in her life. Subsequently, in 2020, she completed a Master of Music in Music Therapy at Arizona State University. This included fulfilling her internship, completing her neurologic music therapy training, and eventually working as a part-time clinician under the tutelage of Suzanne Oliver at Neurologic Music Therapy Services of Arizona. Her experiences working with various neurodivergent populations in a clinical setting led her to become curious regarding the many facets of NMT. Jesse's current research interests include the application of NMT regarding motor learning, sensory processing, and self-regulation in children with autism. Welcome, Jesse. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. Can you just start by introducing yourself a little bit by means of explaining the different projects that you've got on at the moment, your different work, your different research, and what a sort of average week might look like if there is such a thing?
Sure. Yeah. Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I am very excited to be here. So average week, that's a tough one. I feel like a day in the life of a neurologic music therapist is always different. Especially with like the type of work that we do, plus, you know, being a clinician as well as a PhD candidate. So my days are, like a patchwork. So I can give you a bit of a sense. Right now, I see clients via telehealth because I actually don't live in the same area as my clients, which is one of the silver linings, I think, that came out of the pandemic. I continue to have the ability to see my clients, and it's actually given me a lot more tools that I've built over the last couple of years, and just understanding how to explain things differently or use less or more verbiage, or how to demonstrate things over video, or how to effectively give instructions to the caretaker or the parent. You know, these are things that I really never had to do in clinic unless somebody came in and watched or, you know, really sought that information. So anyway, definitely spending time doing telehealth sessions with clients and spending time with my developing my research. So I just finished my comprehensive exams in June. I also hold two TA positions at the University of Toronto where I'm studying. And so I supervise master's students in their practicums, and I watch them work and I give them feedback and I help them to develop their skills as neurologic music therapists. I also sometimes am a guest facilitator for the neurologic music therapy trainings, which is an opportunity for me to get to teach what I've learned, in my journey of becoming a neurologic music therapist and then taking it further with, you know, my further education.
So let's talk about your research for a little bit. Would you mind just giving us a broad sketch of the kind of things that you're researching, and then we can pull out some specific strands?
Yeah. So my research is rooted in this knowledge that autism spectrum disorder is more than just a psychological neurodevelopmental disorder. So it pulls from this novel wave of empirical research that demonstrates the presence of underlying motor deficits in individuals with ASD. And this has really been revolutionizing our fundamental understanding of the disorder. There's some great reviews by Downey and Rapport. I think that's 2012. There's a wonderful comprehensive one by Fournier and colleagues in 2010. So there's a lot of like reviews that are starting to gather all of this research that dive deep into, you know, what are the underlying motor deficits in ASD and how do they present? And, you know, furthermore, that the presence of these deficits, you know, do they foreshadow and underpin higher cognitive functions? And, you know, it's such as social communication and language. And the research really demonstrates evidence for that. But, you know, the most current clinical practice or the gold standard for treatment in ASD really emphasizes like behavior modifications and these approaches to address social and language outcomes where motor deficits are oftentimes left unaddressed. So overall, this is like deeper understanding of the mechanisms that underlie motor deficits in ASD paired with this need to investigate effective clinical techniques to assess and target these motor differences is really the driving force behind my research. And, you know, where does music fit in? So, you know, that's a big piece of it as well. So, music has really become increasingly prevalent in the treatment of symptomology of ASD. So a lot of studies show that people with ASD demonstrate this increased sensitivity to music. And so why not harness that, you know, to help address specific aspects of ASD that may possibly decrease safety of the individual or, you know, don't create optimal functioning for that individual. So we know that music has this rich and widespread neural connectivity in areas that govern motor output, such as the cerebellum, the basal ganglia, and premotor areas. And we also know that even though people with ASD present with motor deficits and sensory motor integration abnormalities, there's these auditory pathways that remain intact. And that music-based intervention actually improves auditory motor connectivity in autistic children. So with all of this incredible evidence that already exists, I think it would really behoove us as researchers to increase our knowledge, to further this knowledge of how music impacts these areas of the brain of autistic individuals. And, you know, this will help to increase our understanding of how to administer optimal treatments such as music to assist individuals in achieving, you know, volitional functioning, like functioning the way they want to function, safe functioning. And, you know, how do we do that? So that's really my research is going to be looking at that. I'll be using three different experiments to target that. And one will be looking at, you know, spontaneous music making and using two different scales. I'll be using EEG to measure electrical output from the brain, as well as like a behavior scale to see if, you know, during music making, do autistic individuals present similarly to neurotypical individuals? And how do they compare, you know, when they're creating music, when they're engaging in spontaneous music making, which would further solidify the use of music to help to achieve optimal functioning. And then my other two are really going to be intervention based. I'll be looking at you know, different types of motor behaviors that that can music optimize motor output, and then also does that cascade then further into optimal social functioning? Is there an increase in social function based on changes in motor and addressing motor?
Do you have any particular anticipated outcomes?
Yeah. So for at least the first one, you know, looking at spontaneous music making, this body of research actually was done, this kind of idea of research was done by Dr. Michael Tout, who is, you know, one of the creators of neurologic music therapy for his dissertation for his master's degree. He looked at this kind of behavioral outcome of spontaneous music making of three different groups. He had neurotypical children, children with autism, and children with developmental delay. But at that time, there was no EEG technology available. So I'm taking that research further and using the technology that we have access to now to not just look at it behaviorally, but look at it from a perspective of, you know, electrical output from the brain. And, you know, research is meant to be replicated. It's meant to be, can we do this over and over again? And so I'm excited that I have this, you know, incredible privilege and opportunity to be able to further that aspect of this research. So that's it. That's, you know, my expected outcome is similar to what that outcome was earlier, was that, you know, some of the deficits that we see in people with autism are surpassed when they're creating music, and their output, their musical output, oftentimes looks similar to that of people who are neurotypical. And so, you know, just solidifying that music is a really great clinical tool and a very effective clinical tool to facilitate change, to drive change in the brain in order to help them reach the goals that they want to reach.
So you talk about this new way of viewing autism as underlined by motor differences as a paradigm shift, and I think it is. And I think that there's, while you cite research that is almost a decade old now, certainly, at least for my understanding, it was quite novel, to use your words, when I encountered it for the first time. And so it's sort of reassuring as well as exciting to hear you describe it like you are on this this wave, this new wave of thinking and changing attitudes towards viewing autism and then viewing the role that music has within the treatment and therapies that people with ASD can encounter.
It's such an interesting thing because I will, you know, happily, you know, tell the audience here that I only recently became a neurologic music therapist. This is a bit of a new career path for me. And so I started studying, my undergrad is in music education. So I studied at Berklee College of Music with undergrad. I spent about a decade producing music, writing music, being a troubadourist, if you will. And only recently have I kind of turned my focus onto, you know, doing something with music and the skills that I've built as a musician to help people more directly. You know, that was always my goal as a performer and as a songwriter. I wanted to be able to have a platform and a voice, literally and figuratively, in order to help people. And I had this blog about, you know, like what my music meant. And I wrote a lot about mental health, and I detailed my own struggles, my own, you know, physical struggles with some vocal issues that I had in my early 20s. And, you know, I've always wanted to use music to help people. And so when I became disenchanted with the music business, I really turned my focus back onto, you know, what can I do? What's important in my life? And what's important to me is music and helping people. And that's when I came to this conclusion that I think I need to further research and understand, you know, is becoming a music therapist a possibility for me? And it was very quickly. I auditioned for a position at as a master student at Arizona State University. And I started the equivalency program there because as an undergrad with music education, I was eligible to kind of have this accelerated first year of like music therapy crash courses and then do my internship and then finish with those master's courses to complete that portion of my education in order to do what I'm doing now. I will say that, you know, the first portion of my education in music therapy versus my internship in neurologic music therapy were two very different experiences. And, you know, I learned that traditional route with autism, with that, you know, that initial education that I received. And then once I landed the internship with Suzanne Oliver at Neurologic Music Therapy Services of Arizona, my whole perspective changed. And I will tell you that my initial internship, my first choice was at a placement with working with mental health. And I was not chosen, and I was devastated. It was something that I really was, I had my hopes up for it. I really wanted it, and I didn't get it. And NMTSA was my second choice. And it was kind of a whim. I applied, and I just didn't think it would be something that I would get, and I did get it. And goodness, am I so happy that I did not get the first internship, because Yeah, like it just, it has really changed my life. And I shifted from being a music therapist to a neurologic music therapist, which, you know, really has helped me, you know, acutely focus on how I use music. What is the function of the music and how does music drive the change in the, you know, the clients that I'm working with? And it seems like this broken record, right? I hear it from, you know, my supervisors and I say it to my students and I think about it when I approach treatment in my sessions, but it gives me a concrete scientific approach to what I'm doing. And so all that said, back to your initial question about, you know, these motor deficits in autism, I was introduced to a wonderful, wonderful researcher. Her name is Dr. Elizabeth Torres, and she is out of Rutgers University, and she is producing incredible research with her students in her lab about underlying motor deficits in autism. And she's using this paradigm and this paradigm shift that you spoke of, you know, what if we were to look at it like, you know, other motor, you know, pathologies such as Parkinson's disease, you know, what if we were able to look at it from that perspective and, you know, turn that triangle upside down. Right now we're, you know, we're really focused on this idea of autism being a psychological or psychiatric disorder that then produces other issues such as motor deficits. But what if we were to flip that? What if we were to look at, you know, like does maybe underlying motor deficit then cascade into higher social cognitive issues? And that body of research pulls from another body of research from the 90s by this researcher Teitelbaum. And he looked at home videos from children who were later diagnosed with autism, home videos of them under the age of 2, where they already were presenting with motor differences. And then later they received that diagnosis of autism. And they compared that to people who were neurotypical and later, you know, stayed neurotypical. And, you know, we're seeing this research, but, you know, it just needs a voice. It needs a place in the scientific community that's heard. And I think the more good research, and I say good research, meaning research that's, you know, replicable, and that we can continue to prove it over and over and over again without a doubt that this is true, then we can really start to see, you know, what we can do with it. We can, opportunities will open, you know, assessment opportunities and treatment opportunities. And that's what happened with Parkinson's. And initially it started out, you know, that it was just these subjective clinical observations. And then eventually it really became more quantitative. And so we're on that same path with autism. We just need to really produce more good research in order to get there.
One of the things that I've loved in taking on this new paradigm is the understanding of how essentially just looking at the body is an insight into the brain and how relevant the extraneous or otherwise movements of the person we're working with can help us to understand sort of what is relevant in that session. And then the understanding that peripheral nervous system has greater neuroplasticity than the central nervous system and how we can actually influence the structures and the connectivity of the brain through the movement exercises that we do in clinic. It's very empowering for a clinician actually to be able to have that such a concrete vision of what we're trying to achieve, right?
I agree with you. I love having this concrete scientific knowledge when I walk into any session with any client, you know, like looking at like, what do I know and how can I use what I know based on the research as opposed to trying to throw, you know, not that this is what other people do, but, you know, I have many times felt like I was throwing spaghetti at the wall, you know, and seeing what sticks, you know, and being like, I don't know what I'm doing. But having this body of research and going back to the research and going back to, you know, knowing what works based on the evidence that's demonstrated is so comforting. I once said in one of my my classes, and one of my professors just kind of like giggled at me, but I was like, having this research and having like the knowledge of the TDM, right? And having the knowledge of how to build, you know, session plans and like having this this, all of this body of work feels like a nice warm blanket. Like, I feel very comforted by it. And I love that it's there and available and I can always go back to it. And I also am really excited that I have the opportunity to contribute to it.
Yeah. And it just hit me the significance of that aspect of your research too, for a clinician that, as we were just talking about, you've got that, the visual representation of the neurology in the body, and you can see how that's impacted in real time. But then you're taking that extra step of adding a thick doona on top of the warm blanket in making a tangible link between the body and behavior, social, emotional, or the other aspects of a person's life, so that we can come into a session saying, I see different arm swing, but that's not the end of it. I can then safely assume that there's going to be like all sorts of other aspects of that person's life that's going to be implicated by that change in whatever it is, arm swing or the way they're stepping or something like
right.
that.
Right. And I think, you know, one other thing that's really important to mention here that's a big aspect of my research is multisensory integration. And if we're not able to develop at, you know, at a very, that sensitive window when we're developing the understanding and the implications of the environment around us, and if we can't process that and put that all together, it makes motor very difficult. It makes social very difficult. And so if we can't, you know, like everything around us right now, you know, our auditory, our visual, our proprioception, our tactile, like we gain so much information and we don't even think about it. Like we just take it for granted. It's there. We know how to process it. It processes so fast. But if that development is disrupted or there is disconnect in, you know, creating those multisensory connections, then we're going to have trouble, you know, being able to function in the way that we want to function.
I was going to bring it to the work that I've observed you do, which is been predominantly about this arousal piece. I think it's probably a bit of a mind shift for a lot of music therapists, just that arousal can be a therapeutic outcome in its own right, as opposed to just a precursor to then getting on to the real, in inverted brackets, work.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we refer back to the intervention that I know that you're talking about, which is musical sensory orientation training, otherwise known as MSOT, when I initially was introduced to that intervention, I really didn't think much of it. Like, it just seems like, okay, we're just going to orient and get ready and we're going to get into, like you had said, like the real work, quote unquote. But I have had the ability now to kind of live in MSOT for a lot of what I do. And I think even, you know, with my conversations with Suzanne and some of the support chapters that I've attended and, you know, some of the work that, you know, I'm doing for the chapter, for the new handbook, you know, I've been able to dive a lot deeper into what is MSOT and what is sensory orientation, and is that enough of an outcome to focus on for one person? And yes, it is. I mean, sometimes that is what you're looking at is this sensory orientation, this, you know, awareness, this, you know, what, how can music be applied, and what is, how can you use music functionally to gain more awareness or bring more orientation to your client's space.
So is that the sort of thing that you're feeding into the contribution that you're making to the new handbook?
I've been invited to contribute based on my knowledge and my work on, you know, working with people with autism spectrum disorder and developmental delay and the use of MSOT, because oftentimes, you know, we jump straight into what we think is APT, right? Auditory perception training. And so, you know, I think that, you know, we're understanding better how MSOT is so important with that population and how it primes your brain for other types of cognitive training. And that, you know, sometimes we think we're an APT, but we're actually an MSOT. And so, you know, and we've had a lot of discussions around that. And so those discussions have sparked, you know, there is a need for a new contribution in that area of MSOT as well as APT. And so those are the two chapters that I'm, you know, very honored to be able to contribute to.
Let's zoom out a little bit now, and you can answer this in whatever way you would like to. It's a very broad question for a reason. So given all of the above, what developments do you foresee in music therapy practice, and how do you think we as an industry and clinicians should evolve to reflect these new findings in our practice?
Yeah, no, I mean, this is such an important question. I think, and this is just my one person's opinion, I think we need to always be ready to abandon our preconceived notions of what we were taught and what we think or what was told to us. I think, you know, oftentimes, you know, we get stuck in like, well, this is the way that I was taught, right? Or this is the way that I learned it. Or this is, you know, this is how my professor taught me how to do it. And I am always of this school of thought that not only am I an ever-changing ocean, but the people that I work with are ever-changing oceans, right? We can't put people in boxes. We can't put diagnoses in boxes because, you know, even, certain pathologies that we have researched over and over and over again, we're finding new things. Science is showing us new aspects of that. Technology is proving to, you know, help us better understand. And so I will, you know, echo what I said, always be ready to abandon your preconceived notions and welcome what you see and observe and don't cherry pick what you want to see and leave your own agenda as a clinician at the door, because it's not about you as the clinician. It's about your client and the population. And, you know, I think too often we cling to these session plans that we've written, or we cling to these previous, you know, notions that we've been taught, and then we become, you know, our focus becomes too narrow. And so I think that we need to share research as much as we can. We need to disseminate the research. We need to read it. We need to discuss it. We need to come to the table and challenge it. You know, I love a good, I love when I don't have the answer, Joe. I love, because I'm like, I don't know. I need to go look that up, you know, because I don't have all the answers, and, you know, neither do the top researchers. And that's why we need to continue to research. And I think the more we can read the research, the more we can produce research that is, when I say, you know, legible, I mean figuratively legible. Like I want to produce research that isn't like trying to write in this academic way that people can't understand. I want to produce research that people can understand and that we can come to the table as equals and have a discussion about it. There's a wonderful, I think he's a neuroscientist. Do you know the Huberman Lab, that podcast, Andrew Huberman?
No.
I believe he's a professor at Stanford, and he basically created this podcast about neuroscience where, yes, he produces research, and yes, he's, you know, highly academic and he can speak that language, but he's created this podcast for people to better understand neuroscience if you've never studied neuroscience in your life. And I think it's really important to be able to have those conversations in ways that everybody can understand, everybody can be on the same page, and everybody can have the advantage of this research, as opposed to, you know, having it be either less accessible, or, you know, it's, you know, we don't talk about it, or, and I think that's why I'm so excited about all of these new support chapters that the Academy has created, the Neurologic Music Therapy Academy, because we can come to a, you know, a space, an open space, a supportive space where we can have these discussions. And, you know, so to your question, I think the more welcoming and the more open and the more involved we can all be as music therapists, neurologic music therapists, we can start to, you know, better unify and better, you know, understand, you know, how we're using music what is the function of the music and how it changes. It changes. We can't be stuck in the same thing. You know, we have to be able to change.
If you could go back in time and give yourself, when you were a student at ASU, some advice, what would you say to that person?
I would say to not spend so much time building my session plans. Or think about like perfecting my session plans, right? And having them be just a little bit more like loose, I guess. You know, I think it's really good in the development of understanding why we're doing and what we're doing to go through the process of how to build a session plan and how to do that. Because even in my undergrad, right, I studied music education, I built lesson plans. And so, you know, lesson plans as a music educator, I feel like are a bit more concrete and you have to pivot a little bit less with that just because it's just, it's a little bit different. It's a different type of platform. You have different goals. But as a music therapist, I think it's important to be able to, yes, I need to go through this thought process. I think it's important to be able to learn how to build session plans, understand why I'm doing what I'm doing, but not make them so perfect that when you throw them out, you're, you know, grieving the death of this beautiful piece of work that you spent so many hours on. Like it's not, we cannot be attached to those. And what you could do is maybe build like a bank of session plans where you can patchwork them together and think retrospectively like, okay, well, maybe, you know, why did I have to go from here to here and then from there to here and then there to there and then be able to put together this like, okay, well, this is really what the session plan ended up looking like and this is why I did what I did.
What is your favorite thing about being a music therapist?
Oh, the people. I love working with the people. I will say that telehealth has been wonderful because I've been able to still, you know, see clients that normally I wouldn't be able to see all over the country. I really miss the in-person interactions that I have with my clients. You know, it definitely is a different platform, but, you know, I really love serving the people that I serve. I can feel the tangible effects of what I do and I can see it from week to week and I can, you know, I can see the impact that I'm having on these individual families. And, you know, when I was a musician and I looked out into my audience and I was performing on stage, I saw shadows, right? Because there's always lights that are like shining in your face and you can't really see their faces and you can see they're bopping along to the music or they're chit-chatting with their friends and they're having a good time. And I feel like I brought them joy because, you know, they showed up and they stayed. But I can see my clients' faces and I can see the impact that I'm having. And I, you know, unfortunately, you know, sometimes I have to, you know, I can't take all of the clients that I want to take on my caseloads. And, you know, recently, like I've had to shift from having a larger caseload to now to a smaller caseload because I'm going into my back into my studies. And I just get these incredible emails from families about, you know, all of the impact that I'm having and the changes that I'm making. And, you know, I feel very honored that I am welcome into their homes, for lack of better, you know, word, because I am. And that I can be a part of that team. And that is the most rewarding piece of what I do.
And that is a lovely place to end it, I think. So let me say thank you so much for your time, Jesse. I really appreciate it, knowing especially all the demands on your time and for your insight and wisdom here. Honestly, I think this is a conversation that I think a lot of people will get a lot out of. So thank you again. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you for listening to Baselines. If you enjoyed the show, please hit follow and leave a rating and a review. My single purpose for making this podcast is that it helps us, the music therapists of today, to think clearly and carefully about what we do. I hope today's episode has given you something valuable to consider for your work and your practice.